Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 18th of February, these are our main stories. A leaked document from China seen by the BBC provides detailed new evidence of the crackdown on Muslims in the western region of Xinjiang. The United Nations says that fighting in the Syrian province of Idlib has displaced close to 1 million people since December. A prominent Rwandan gospel singer has been found dead in a police cell 3 days after he was arrested. Also in this podcast...
This vessel has been drifting empty and abandoned in the Atlantic. Many people thought it had actually sunk until it appeared out of the winds and rain to find itself driven onto the coast of East Cork.
The ghost ship that's run aground on an Irish beach. New evidence of China's crackdown on Muslim minorities in its western province of Xinjiang has been revealed in a leaked document seen by the BBC. In huge detail, the document sets out how the authorities decided the fate of more than 300 Uyghur detainees, just a fraction of the million or so held in secure facilities across the region. The Chinese embassy in London insisted their so-called vocational educational centres were designed to tackle terrorism and religious extremism. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landell has seen the document. He says it provides a rare glimpse into the inner workings of the Chinese state.
Some of it seems quite random. That some people have just described they've been detained because they are, quote, untrustworthy, close, which can be, mean anything. Some people have been detained, these documents show, for having a passport, for having applied for a passport, for having a relative who lives overseas, for having clicked unintentionally on a foreign website when you're looking at the internet. So that one part of it is, you know, do you have any kind of link overseas? Secondly, there's a lot of data here about people's religious practices, how often they worship, which mosque they go to, how they fast, how many times a day they pray. Some of it is seemingly random. You know, some people were detained for wearing a long beard or having a veil. But also... lots and lots of details about these people's circles, their families, their friends, their religious contacts. And it seems to be that if you have one contact that maybe was very religious and you wore a beard, those two facts were put together and were used as a rationale for detaining people.
So how do we know whether or not these documents are, in fact, authentic?
Well, it's impossible to know 100% because there are no official markings or the documents that say this is a Communist Party of this particular region or whatever. However, the experts that I've spoken to, there's a guy called Dr. Adrian Zenz who studies this, and he has studied this document incredibly closely. He's cross-referenced all the names. I mean, there are about 3,000 names in this document of all these contacts. He's looked at their identity numbers, cross-referenced them with publicly available records. The language is similar to official language. The detail is just so voluminous that the experts are pretty sure that it's pretty solid material and enough for them to believe that it's verifiable. Now, it's come to the West through a consortium of other media organisations, and it's been leaked from the region through a series of people. But it emerged and was finally made public by a Uyghur lady who's an exile living in Amsterdam called Asiya Abdullaheb. And she said that these documents were authentic, but it was really important in her mind for them to be published.
Under this condition, there is no need for me to hide myself. Of course, I am worried about the safety of my relatives and friends, but if everyone keeps silent because they want to protect themselves and their families, then we will never prevent these crimes being committed.
So that's Asiya, the lady who really finally brought these documents out into the open. How has Beijing, the government there, been reacting?
We have just got a statement from the Chinese embassy in London. Essentially, the points they're making is, look, they are fighting terrorism and religious extremism in this part of China, and they insist that what they're doing does not target any specific region or ethnic group or religion. So that's the first point. The second point they make is that these camps, they don't call them camps, so they call them vocational educational centres, are designed to fight that terrorism and extremism, but where people who are taken in learn Chinese, they learn a bit of law, vocational skills, de-radicalisation, whatever that means in this context. And they specifically insist that the only criterion for people entering these camps are that they've been convicted of unlawful or criminal acts involving terrorism and religious extremism. Now, that is directly contrary to the evidence suggested in the leaked document, which claims that clearly many other criteria are used to detain many people here.
James Landale, the BBC's diplomatic correspondent. Idlib, the last rebel-held province in Syria, is facing an onslaught by President Assad's forces. The fighting has forced 900,000 people to flee since the beginning of December. That's according to the United Nations, which also says that the displaced, who are mostly women and children, are forced to sleep in the open in freezing conditions because the camps are full. Paul Adams reports.
Government supporters are ecstatic. President Assad's troops making significant gains near the northern city of Aleppo, taking in a matter of hours ground that's been contested for years. With Russian help, the government's momentum seems relentless. And as the troops advance, civilians retreat in vast numbers. In neighbouring Idlib province, the roads are clogged with fleeing people, 850,000 displaced in just 2.5 months. Leaving deserted, shattered towns behind them. In ground not yet taken by government forces, displaced people settle and live where they can. Winter now adding to their misery. Mohammed is struggling to keep her family warm and fed. In the hills along the Turkish border, it's safe, but freezing.
We're suffering from the cold. We used to have a comfortable life in the past, and look where we are now. We can't even afford wood for heating, but we still thank God Almighty.
The family has moved twice in recent months. Each time, the fighting has caught up with them. With her daughters and granddaughter, Mohammed sits and waits, knowing that in time, they may have to move again. The camp is isolated, one of hundreds now dotting the landscape. Getting aid to these places is a challenge. Hussam is a local volunteer, salting the road to try and keep it open.
The situation inside the camps is grim now. Usually there is some activity and life in the camps. Roads are open and food and heating reaches people, but after the latest snowstorm, everything now is extremely bad.
The UN says the cold is now its main concern. More than half of those on the move are children. Some have died. The situation in Idlib has been catastrophic for years, and it's still getting worse.
That was Paul Adams. One of Rwanda's most high-profile gospel singers has been found dead in a police cell. Police say Kizito Mihigo killed himself, but government critics say that's just not credible. The singer had survived the Rwandan genocide in 1994 and written a well-known requiem on the subject. Urupfu ni cyo kibi kiruta ibindi. Well, some of Mr. Mihigo's music had been banned in the past in Rwanda. His songs had criticised the ruling party and suggested everyone killed during the 1994 genocide should be remembered, whether or not they were Hutu or Tutsi. I asked our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, what we know about the circumstances of his death.
Well, we have the version from the Rwandan police, which says that he was found dead in his cell, having killed himself. Just to go back a few days, last week he was arrested close to the border with Burundi, and the police said that he had been trying to get across the border in order to join rebels in Burundi. Now, that's the Rwandan version of events. Amnesty International has just put out a press release saying that it is very shocked by his death and wants the Rwandan authorities to carry out an independent investigation to find out whether indeed it was suicide or homicide. And there are activists and government critics who really question the whole narrative that's come from the police, saying they don't believe he committed suicide. They think he was killed. And they also say there's no way he was going to join rebels in Burundi because they have evidence that he was trying to get to Belgium, where he had lived before.
And now people are questioning what really happened because of the context to all this. There have been a number of suspicious deaths and disappearances of government opposition activists over the last decade or so, haven't there?
They have. Some have included efforts to kill people who used to be very close to the governing party, who then fled the country, for example, to South Africa, former military people who were once close to President Paul Kagame. And that is why, once again, you know, there are questions being asked as to whether, you know, the official version of events here is true. And I should add that Kizito Mihigo, you know, had a very controversial past, partly because some of the lyrics in his music upset the authorities. And in particular, he released one song which seemed to question the official narrative about what happened in the genocide. The Rwandan authorities call it the genocide of the Tutsis. Mm. And he wrote this song saying that Hutus and Tutsis should be remembered. And that really, many people put him at loggerheads with the authorities. And that's possibly why he was targeted.
Let's get a brief update now on the battle against coronavirus. As of Monday, more than 70,000 cases had been identified in China. Almost 1,800 people have died so far. And perhaps belatedly, a high-level delegation from the World Health Organization is now in China to investigate the handling of the disease there. Michael Ryan is the head of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program.
The team have had a series of face-to-face meetings with the Chinese counterparts, and it's excellent to see such eminent international experts working side by side with their Chinese counterparts now. Much of the work over the last 72 hours has been in laying out and agreeing on what are those outstanding questions. We've been speaking about those unknowns, and it's agreeing what we know, agreeing what we don't know, and agreeing what is the best way to access the information on what we don't know. The team will then be able to go and visit provinces and see things on the ground and continue those that work together. And again, we reflect on the fact that this is a collaboration between Chinese scientists and scientists from the international community.
Michael Ryan from the WHO. Now, you might have heard of the Flying Dutchman, a famous fictional ghost ship that never made it to port, forced to sail the high seas for eternity. Well, now the Irish Coast Guard are dealing with a real ghost ship, the MV Alta, which may end up having a slightly different fate. It's been drifting crewless and abandoned in the Atlantic for more than a year, but it ran aground in storms off the coast of Cork on Sunday. There are now fears that any oil or diesel on board may leak. Ralph Regal is covering the story for the Irish Independent newspaper.
The comparisons have been made to the Flying Dutchman and to the Marie Celeste, and it really has been a journey very much like that. This ship, it's 44 years old, and it had been allegedly the focus of an attempted hijacking off the coast of Africa back about 10 years ago. And it was on a journey from Piraeus in Greece to Port-au-Prince in Haiti, when about 1,000 miles southeast of Bermuda, it had severe engine problems. The 20-strong crew were unable to fix the ship, so it was drifting for a number of days. The crew then ran out of food, ran out of water, and they had to be rescued as part of a very complex operation by the US Coast Guard. So since October 2018, this vessel has been drifting empty and abandoned in the Atlantic. Now, the last major sighting of it was by the HMS Protector, an ice survey vessel, which saw it in the mid-Atlantic back last October. And they had taken photographs of it. They had posted alerts about the vessel, and it had vanished since then. Many people thought it had actually sunk, until it appeared out of the winds and rain in Storm Dennis to find itself driven onto the coast of East Cork.
That was Ralph Regal. Still to come on this podcast.
My first couple boyfriends left me for other women. And so for a decade after that, I was subconsciously dating in fear and thinking if I was going to be left again, at least I'd still have my virginity.
A woman who dated more than 100 men and remained a virgin until she was 41 years old. The last president of South Africa in the apartheid era, F.W. de Klerk, has apologised for refusing to say the system of racial segregation was a crime against humanity. During an interview with the country's national broadcaster, SABC, earlier this month, Mr. de Klerk said he couldn't fully agree with that view. His comments were condemned, including by the prominent anti-apartheid campaigner Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And as our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding explains, the row looks set to continue.
Here in South Africa, the past is still raw.
Can we agree that it was a crime against humanity and it was evil?
When a television presenter asked that question to the former president, F.W. de Klerk, he was expecting a simple yes. After all, the United Nations agreed decades ago that racial apartheid was indeed a crime against humanity. Instead, South Africa's last white minority leader ummed and erred.
I don't fully agree with that. I'm not justifying apartheid in any way whatsoever.
But why can't you agree with that?
That exchange provoked outrage here, at a time when some black South Africans are starting to question the compromises that allowed the white minority to surrender power but retain their land and wealth. Archbishop Desmond Tutu urged Mr. de Klerk to show more compassion at a time when he said South Africa stood on an economic precipice, with those who'd suffered most under apartheid still suffering most today. But others here insist that the row over Mr. de Klerk's comments is being fuelled by politicians anxious to deflect attention from the governing ANC's own spectacular failings. Earlier today, Mr. de Klerk, now 83, apologised for quibbling about the wrongs of apartheid, saying his comments were completely unacceptable. Some voices are still calling for him to be stripped of the Nobel Peace Prize he shared in 1993 with Nelson Mandela.
Let's go to Egypt now, because the Musicians' Union there has announced a ban on a popular style of music known locally as mahraganat. For the uninitiated, this is what it sounds like. Well, the music has become hugely popular amongst the poor, with the working class performers attracting millions of followers on social media platforms. Yusuf Taha from our Arabic desk, tell me more.
It is very different from the usual mainstream music in Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab world, where you have one singer standing there and singing the lyrics written by some songwriter or poet, and usually you don't shake it too much.
There's no sort of shaking of the body, sort of not sexual.
Not usually. And they would have a whole band playing behind them. While these mahraganat music singers, you just need to have a voice. The music is electronica, and anyone can do it. And that's how it started 15 years ago in Egypt. It started with working class singers who just wanted to have a voice, have a bit of fun too, and maybe in the process make some money. So 5 years ago or so, it had attracted wider audiences among the middle classes and also highbrow people too. The authorities don't like it very much because they think it goes against the values and the morals of the Egyptian society. The lyrics are quite straightforward and they're, say, sometimes obscene. And on Valentine's Day, there was a mahraganat gig at Cairo Stadium and there was over 100,000 people there. So surely this kind of music is finding a great followership. However, the authorities say they need to protect public taste.
And what's been the reaction about this particular ban? Is there enough of a opposition to it, do you think, for it to be overturned?
I don't think it's going to be a matter of overturning the ban, but the issue will be ignoring it. So the singers continue to perform. They perform at wedding parties, they perform at hotels, they perform at nightclubs, and people continue to listen to them, whether online by streaming these songs or buying their albums. So, for example, I know some people in Egypt who are quite highbrow, and they said if that ban means they would be breaking the law, they will continue listening.
That was Yusuf Taha. Now to a very personal story from a woman who remained a virgin until she was 41 years old, even though she'd dated more than 100 men. Amanda McCracken just never met the right guy for her. She wrote about her celibacy for the New York Times and said that she knew in her heart that she only wanted sex within a committed relationship. Now there's a happy ending, as she told Lawrence Pollard.
I was waiting for love and commitment. I wanted to be in a relationship where there's that mutual love and commitment, and I believe it existed.
Take us through the attitudes that were revealed by you deciding to wait.
I was actually pretty surprised by the criticism that rolled in when I published the New York Times essay. I felt punished, actually, for being so honest. I now realize how naive I was to think my story would be accepted, since I lived in a progressive culture where women are encouraged to do with their bodies what they wish to do.
How were those attitudes? How did they hit you? What were you hit with?
I just felt attacked for not following mainstream society with having sex, I guess, outside of a relationship and lots of it.
Why did you get under their skin so much, do you think?
I think it's almost like a diet, you know, like you go to a dinner party, you say gluten-free, and everybody assumes that you think that they should be gluten-free too, you know? And I think sobriety has been something that's accepted. Now it's almost trendy, you know, but in the past, people would be like, oh, you know, you don't drink. Well, why? And do you think I shouldn't be drinking?
One thing that does emerge from your writing about it, I'm interested, is there's quite a lot of food analogies.
I think there are, you know, obviously a lot of correlations. And just as I grew up running, and I did have a lot of friends that had eating disorders, and I felt like, you know, where they were resisting food, I was actually resisting sex. And I feel like they were both a way of controlling our lives when things felt like they were getting out of control. My first couple boyfriends left me for other women. And so for a decade after that, I was subconsciously dating in fear and thinking if I was going to be left again, at least I'd still have my virginity. So I was still like holding on to something. And it was still a matter of, it was a bit of a matter of control because I was afraid of being left.
You often hear people kind of saying, oh, you know, I felt it was a bit of a nuisance. I just wanted to get rid of it and so on. Did being a virgin become a nuisance ever?
I would never say it was something that I was like just wanting to get over with at all. I did feel like I started to wonder if actually, you know, my expectations for love and commitment were too high. And if by not having sex with men, I was keeping myself from the love and commitment that I wanted. And then I found that that was really not true.
You've got a story which is about patience, waiting, hoping to do the right thing. People listening to this now want to know how it ended.
Well, everybody wants to know, you know, was it worth the wait? And yes, it was, but not in the way most people would think.
Right.
The sex was great, but this journey was never about the sex. I'm now with a man named Dave in loving, committed relationship with him. And, you know, this was about waiting to enter a relationship with someone who could offer love and for me to be able to receive that love. And that itself was liberating.
Amanda McCracken speaking to Lawrence Pollard. Jacqueline Dupre died in 1987, aged 42. As a cellist, she'd been acclaimed around the world, but by her late 20s, multiple sclerosis had ended her career. Now a new ballet at the Royal Opera House in London sets out to capture the intensity of her talent. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd reports.
About a year after illness cruelly ended Jacqueline Dupre's career, she recorded an interview for BBC Radio which contained a kind of hope.
I feel that I've gone through, perhaps, maybe I'm speaking too early, through the hardest times when it comes to fright and sense of uselessness and hopelessness. It's a horrid thing to have to be dependent, and it can make one feel furious at times.
Dupre lived for another decade coping with MS, but never again able to play. From her late teens, she'd been in demand as a cellist. There was a freshness and dynamism and a lack of reserve, which some critics hadn't liked. Now in The Cellist, choreographer Cathy Marston has tried to capture Dupre's complex character in dance. The idea started close to home.
My sister's a teacher near Cambridge, a drama teacher, and she found a battered-up cello and asked her students to improvise with this cello and put on the music of Jacqueline Dupre playing the Elgar Cello Concerto. She thought it was incredibly inspiring and gave me the idea, which resonated particularly because our mother has MS.
The score incorporates works she was associated with, such as the Elgar Cello Concerto. Her 1965 Kingsway Hall recording, under John Barbarolli, is still regarded by many as the best ever. Lauren Cuthbertson is the ballerina who has to evoke Jackie.
She was quite a strong, commanding presence and very fun-loving, very witty, very clever, and obviously incredibly gifted. Luckily, it's been wonderful to research her because there's so much footage. She liked to absorb life and everything that it has to offer and put that into her music as well.
The three main characters represent Jackie, Daniel Barenboim, who she married in 1967, and a cello, danced by Marcelino Sombe.
He's very contemplative. He's really looking and being nostalgic most of the time. So it's almost like he's in the present looking at the past. So he has a lot of weight in his shoulders. And that's how it sounds. So I'm a dancer, so I can relate if my talent was taken away from me, and which is my body and my physique, and I could no longer do what I love. Obviously, it would be very heartbroken. So we all are very close to this story.
Cathy Marston didn't want the ballet to be only about multiple sclerosis, but she was sensitive to its effects.
Perhaps more sensitive than I might otherwise be to it because of my mother. It's closer, it's more personal as a theme. So the dancers and I have spoken to people with MS, I've done a lot of reading, and as she's in this situation, accumulating behind her are the corps de ballet, expressing the symptoms of MS, and the symptoms get more and more and more, and then suddenly subside, because with remitting MS, relapsing and remitting MS, which she had, one day you can wake up, it's okay again for a period of time.
The cellist celebrates Jacqueline Dupre's talent and her courage, even as she knew her health could only grow worse.
I shall have around me people who are totally steadfast. I shan't be left literally alone, as well as perhaps in my own head.
The cellist is at the Royal Opera House in London. It will be relayed live to cinemas around the world next week.
Vincent Dowd reporting there. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, let's hear from my colleague Jackie Leonard, who wants to hear from you so you can help us with a special one-off podcast coming soon.
Every day we're hearing more about the coronavirus and how it's affecting people's lives. There are so many different angles to this story. So we're going to have an extra edition of the Global News podcast focused entirely on the coronavirus. If you have a question about it, on anything from travel to prevention, treatment, politics, misinformation, the economic impact, anything in fact, just send it in and we'll see if our panel of experts can provide the answer. If you can, record yourself telling us who and where you are and what it is you want to know. Attach the recording to an email and send your question to the usual address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk.
Jackie Leonard there, and there's going to be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.